This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls all over the world, via web, via YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, however it is that you are accessing the Game Dev Unchained podcast, I first want to thank you. And you know this voice, it is Larry Charles. I am one half of the amazing hosting team for this semi-mediocre podcast. You know that there's another half involved in this. Who else could it be other than my best friend, Mr. Brandon Pham?
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to this week's special episode. Please welcome our guest for this week, Yuri Nedelin.
Yuri.
Hi, guys. This is Yuri.
How's it going, man?
It's going good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. How does it feel? You're famous now, man. There's like 89 people listening to this as we speak. 89
people.
Well, you know, we're growing one step at a time.
Yes, we are. No, to all the podcast listeners out there who support us, thank you very much. So Yuri, it is a tradition whenever we bring a new guest onto the show, we give them an opportunity to just talk to the fans and tell them about themselves. So walk us through your resume, if you don't mind. Why is it that you're so cool as a game developer? What have you done exactly?
Okay. Well, so my game development career is not... it's not as old as I am. So I started in video games kind of late. I was about 30 years old maybe 29 when I got my first video game job.
Okay.
Since then I was able to work. I worked, I think, in five different companies. So I started with Genuine Games in LA. Then I was working for The Collective.
Oh, nice.
And then it became Shiny. Then it became Amazon Studios. After Collective, I was working for Sony Santa Monica. And after that, I was working for Infinity Ward. And after Infinity Ward, I started working for a studio called Section Studios in downtown LA. And so that's where I am now. So yeah, I have quite a bit of experience considering that I've only been in the industry for less than 15 years. And I've worked on a few smaller projects. I think there were 12 of 8 games that shipped, the one games that I've worked on. Mm-hmm. I have experience working on a project that are small budget, quick turnaround, 9 months projects, and large big games like God of War and Call of Duty.
Mm-hmm. Well, Yuri, I don't have really an ear for accents, but that doesn't sound like an American accent to me. And you mentioned you got in the industry later. What were you doing before? And where you from, man?
Yeah. So right. So I came to US after high school. So I was born in Ukraine and studied in Ukraine. Went to school in Ukraine and then came to US to go to university. And my career choice at that point in time was music, and I was training to be a professional classical musician.
Wow.
And after that, yeah, it's kind of a curvy road. So after finishing that, I actually ended up getting a job and playing for Atlanta Opera, and then I was playing with Atlanta Symphony Orchestra.
What?
So I was playing. Yeah,
hobby, man.
No, it's not a hobby. No, it was pretty serious business. Yeah, I mean, I was a really serious musician, and I was playing for Symphony, and I was a musician for about 10, professionally playing for about, I would say about 10 years, mm-hmm. playing orchestras. And so what happened, I don't know if I will go into this, maybe around when I was 25, I bought a computer, right? And then, so I was living in Atlanta at the time. I was playing a symphony there and opera, and I bought a computer and I was kind of messing around with it. And I started, it was a long time ago, right? And I downloaded the software that was called, so I was getting into Linux at the time. Mm-hmm. And I got a software called Blender. There was a free 3D modeling software for Linux at the time. And so I started messing around with that, learning that. And I got actually really, really good at that software. I made a whole animated film by myself.
Mm. Wow.
Damn.
And yeah, it's, I mean, did everything. It's crazy. And then I felt like I felt like I was getting really good at that software and knew many things. I was on forums. I was able to answer pretty much any question on the forum. And then I thought that I should look for other softwares and see what actual professionals use. And so that would happen. Then I had a girlfriend from Brazil and we went to Brazil together. And at that point, I knew that Maya was the new upcoming software. At the time, it was Maya 1. Mm-hmm. So I went to Brazil, and in Brazil, they have these black markets all over the place where you can buy bootleg software. So I went to one of those markets and there was a dude selling Maya 2 for $1.
Wow.
Damn.
So I just bought it and I came home and installed it and so I started using that. While I was playing in the orchestra, I was doing that, and I was kind of starting doing animation and learning things. And then at some point, I think it was 27, 20, 26, I think it was, I guess it was 26, 27. I decided that I want to do this professionally. And so I answered an ad for an internship for an animation studio in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And these guys called me up, and it's a small team, like five guys. And what they were doing, short, straight to video cartoons for children. Mm-hmm. And they called me up. I flew out there. I quit all my jobs in Atlanta. I drove out to Colorado, and I was working for free for like 3 months.
Yeah.
Damn.
And then at the end of it was like, I guess from September to December, or just the end of December. And then I said to the guy who owned the company, I said, look, if you want to keep me here, you have to pay me something I can't do for free.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Then they hired me. They paid me $25,000 a year.
Uh-huh.
And they hired me as an animator. And so then I was working there for a couple of years. And at that point, I ended up playing. Actually, there was also an audition for orchestra in Colorado Springs. So I got that job. And so for a while, I was working as an animator during the day. And I was working as a musician at night in the symphony there.
Damn. And hold the phone, man. Like, I don't think people realize. So I took an Uber probably like a few months back, and I was talking to the guy who was driving me, and he was saying that he's in the LA area and he's trying to get into symphonies, right? And this guy was around probably 33 or something, and he was telling me casually, like, oh yeah, the average age for someone to play in a symphony as a musician is like 45 or something. Like, it's hard, right? It's a hard thing to actually play professionally as a musician. And you're talking about skipping towns, quitting jobs, and just getting jobs at night, like willy-nilly. Like, how was that? Making things up? It was tough. He's rather, like, that good? Yeah.
He's very talented.
I was very good. Yeah, I was very good. I mean, I was not. The thing is, being a musician and playing orchestra is extremely demanding. And I don't want to steal this podcast.
Yeah,
talk about music, but just briefly is to say, to be an orchestra musician is essentially like winning Olympic Games. There's a lot of complexity in the job of a musician, because in symphony musician, because once you get, it's really hard to get. Competition is very, very difficult, and there's a lot of people competing for these jobs. And generally, if you get a really good full-time job in a major symphony, you're set for life, and you will never be able to change your job.
Yeah.
For me, I had jobs in Atlanta, but I really was, there's a story why I quit.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get into it right now. But in Colorado Springs, for example, the orchestra was much smaller. So for somebody who played professionally in a large orchestra, to get a job in a small orchestra is not that difficult. Mm-hmm. But to get a job in LA Philharmonic or New York Philharmonic or Chicago Symphony or Atlanta Symphony, it is a really, really difficult feat. Mm-hmm. And there are many people competing for those jobs. It's really hard. Mm-hmm. So generally, nobody gets a second job in a major orchestra. It would be really hard. For me, what happened with me, I just quit and I got a job in orchestra in Colorado Springs because it was much smaller and competition was not nearly as steep.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Yeah. So yeah, it's hard. It's hard. It's interesting lifestyle, but it's I think it would be a topic for a different conversation.
Sure.
Well, what I want to illustrate is that you're obviously very disciplined. Like, being able to go from bootleg in Brazil to becoming like landing your job like 2 years later. still like rough, but that the self-taught artist is like the scariest type of artist to me, because that drive and the willingness to just really educate yourself is such a hard thing to overcome. And so for you to do that and be very successful to work at huge companies, that's very commendable. That's a lot tougher than you're making it sound like. It's like Larry and I are paying school loans still.
You know, things have changed since I got into this industry. So things have changed because, you know, when I got into the industry, it was so early on. It was so early in computer graphics that, you know, it was Maya 1 or Maya 2 at a time. There were really just a few. I mean, literally, I think at the time I could just say, hey, I can spell 3D and somebody would give me a job. Back then, you know, it was really, there were no schools for teaching that. There were very few ways to get into this industry other than just learn it yourself. So for me, I was really interested in it. I was fascinated with the whole thing. And so I was able to get into it. And my first job was very, very small. It was five guys, two rooms. And it was like an apartment, two rooms. And it was really fun, but the entry was pretty low. The salary was very low. You know, and those guys, studios like that always have a hard time finding people, particularly back then. I think today is much more difficult to be self-taught because there are lots of schools for teaching that and a lot of expectations for the, you know, for new hires. Mm-hmm. It's fun. It worked out,
obviously. So what happened after the internship became a full-time job? You were still being a musician at night, right?
Yeah, so it's interesting thing happened, Ben. So we were working on this straight-to-video cartoon, and we were doing three shows. Our contract was for three shows, and it was a two-year thing. And then my orchestra was playing. It was great. For a while, I really felt great. Then what happened, so we finished our contract, and my boss somehow decided that it was too stressful to run a company. Mm-hmm. And instead of hiring my people to like make his life easier, he decided just to shut down.
I've heard that before recently.
He was totally just spent. Impossible. And and so he shut down the company, and literally a month later, orchestra filed for bankruptcy.
Wow.
Oh, man.
That's a bad month.
So it happened like March and then April. And so then what happened, I ended up having these two unemployment paychecks from the state of Colorado. So I kind of lived in Colorado so I took a summer off, lived there until about September, October. I didn't do anything, just kind of hung out, worked on my demo reel. And after that, I ended up moving to Chicago to join a friend of mine there. And I got a job in Chicago working in a post-production house as an effects artist. So at the time, it's probably still today, but Chicago was a pretty big center for advertisement industry. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of post houses there that did editing and post work for ads and for short, like for long format video TV. So for like Discovery Channel and History Channel, things like that. So a company I was working for called Swell Pictures, and it was quite a large editing agency and it was like an editing company, post house. Mm-hmm. And there were a few effects artists there. So I was there for about a year, and quality was super low. Mm-hmm. And I really hated being there. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a buddy of mine from my job in Colorado who moved to LA, saying that I'm going to just quit the whole thing and go to medical school or something, do something else, because it's just all crazy. I was very unhappy. Oh. And he said, look, you're very talented. Don't quit. Come to LA and you're going to find people and talent and salaries that you deserve here in LA, because that's where real thing is happening. Mm-hmm. Come to LA. So this dude, his name is Brian Weaver, and he's a close friend of mine. And he was working for a studio called Genuine Games, mm-hmm. right? And those guys at the time were working on the game. They're working on a Fight Club game. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, that's cool. So then I had my company in Chicago send me to LA to SIGGRAPH. Mm-hmm. So when I was here in LA for SIGGRAPH, my buddy arranged an interview for me with the heads of the company of Genuine Games. And they talked to me and they basically just hired me right there.
Wow.
And you got your company to pay for your new job, basically. I mean,
that's slick. So then that was it. So I came back to Chicago. I said, here we go. That's what they're offering me. And the guys in Chicago said, there's no way we can match this. So I was happy to leave. And so that was my first game job. And yeah, and it's history since. It's good.
Right. So
this mama thing. So what's interesting thing was when I was coming to LA, my goal was to get into LA and do whatever I can, working games for a little bit, and basically make my way into visual effects in film. Because the dream was to work in film visual effects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. And I thought I'll come to LA and I'll work here for 6 months with doing video games and get my feet into the visual effects world. And after I got into games and spent 6 months working in games, I realized that I much rather stay in games. Mm-hmm. It is really, really cool. Far better than anything I could imagine in film. And after meeting some people in film, I realized that game industry is far better fit for me. So I stayed in games since then.
So you never made the transition ever to even test it?
No, I knew exactly. I had a really good idea what it was after coming to LA and meeting people and talking to people and realizing what the difference is. And the main difference between games and film at the time, and I'm sure it is the same, but at the time, the difference was that in film, the quality is much higher, but the way to get the quality was not elegant.
Mm-hmm. It's very messy.
And in film, you could be very, very messy. You could just pile all together. You have to worry about big picture. You can just worry you can only worry about the shot you're working on right now. You can get to the goal you're going with, without a lot of elegance and without a lot of technical prowess. Mm-hmm. And for me, I felt like in games we have a lot bigger restrictions, like far greater restrictions, and we far more limited by what we can do. And yet we're still trying to reach that goal of really high quality. And I thought that these limitations and this would be much more interesting to overcome. Mm-hmm. And for me personally. And so, because at that point in time, I was already becoming very technical in my work. And I thought that that would be much, much more challenging and interesting and much more rewarding to work in games rather than in film. Because from that perspective.
Yeah. I mean, what's funny now, is that both the industries are kind of converging. Like film is taking a look over at our VR stuff and real-time graphics, and they're learning to seeing the benefit of having a clean workflow, obviously, just to make it run and look good at the same time. So... yeah, I hear that a lot. Like a lot of people usually chase film for the graphical, fidelity and prowess and everything. But eventually, because of that messiness or just a whole different industry, they have more fun in games.
Yeah, for me, I felt like it's much more exciting to be. Be able to achieve visual quality of film within game using far fewer tools and far fewer assets and doing it in much more elegant and more exciting way. So that it's like using a fine tool to create something, a small beautiful piece of art, than just using a huge sledgehammer to it. That's kind of the way I felt about film versus games. It's to some degree it's still this way. It's still when you think about big film studios and big VFX studios, these people, they can take days to render a frame. Uh-huh. While for us, we have to render 30 of them in a second, and so and visually we're trying to reach the same level. Of course, we'll never be able to games don't look as good as film, but not in foreseeable future. But it's we make such great advances, and it's really exciting for me personally to see the visual progress of video games and how well the systems can sit, how well good pipelines and good engines and good teams can work together to create visuals of that high quality that match some of the film.
Well, speaking of that, like you're talking about 15 years of being in the game industry. You've been through some game cycles. Like you being a technical artist, obviously you chose the game path because the game industry is a little bit more technical in some aspect, at least for graphical fidelity stuff. But like what has been the most exciting generation evolve?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me personally, obviously, it's what's interesting about games, I think, at least thus far, every time new generation comes out, people are just so hyped.
Yeah.
It's so exciting. Every time new console comes out, it's just so exciting. And you really want to work on the next new console. For me, the biggest change was when I was going from PS2 to PS3. That's when I was still working. I was working at Collective on a PS2 game. And then a friend of mine called me from Santa Monica. And he said, hey, I'm working on a PS3 title. But at that time, PS3 hasn't come out yet. And it was just very exciting to be part of that transition. I think being a part of that transition is always very exciting, particularly if you're trying to be at the edge of technology. Mm-hmm. I know that when people went from PS1 to PS2, there was a lot of excitement. For me, PS2 to PS3 was very exciting because I was, on the cutting edge, and I was making game was God of War that was really pushing the limits of that system. And then I think that anytime there's a change from console to console, it's very exciting. And I'm looking forward to see what's going to happen next. It seems like going forward, quality is already so high, it seems like next generation is not going to be that exciting. But something that my experience tells me that next generation will provide something that nobody had thought of before, just like PS2 to PS3 and PS2 to PS4, that is going to be very exciting if we move to next generation as well. With VR, maybe, I don't know. So my personal experience most exciting was going from PS2 to PS3. Because that's when I was really on top of my game and I was doing something that's very groundbreaking. There seemed to be the difference in quality between PS2 and PS3. It was really great.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working on PS4, PC to PS4, my first title on PS4 was Call of Duty. And since we had to ship the game still for PS3 generation, mm-hmm. we didn't really push the graphics as much. And at the time, during that development for Call of Duty Ghosts, pushing graphics was not a huge priority.
Mm-hmm.
When with God of War, going from God of War 2 to God of War 3, pushing graphics was a huge priority for Sony. It was number one most important thing for Sony. So for me personally, the experience was really, really, really fun. The interesting thing to say is that it's just a little insight about the video game development. So with Call of Duty, I'm pretty sure that's what it is. The goal of the game is to make money from the sales of the game.
Okay.
So the idea of that game was mostly, most important thing was to sell as many copies as you can, make as good a big game as possible. With God of War 3, it seemed the goal was a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Sony, God of War only sold maybe 5 million copies. So it's nothing compared to 25 million copies of Call of Duty. But for Sony, I think most valuable thing about God of War 3 was not how many copies the game sells, but how awesome it looks and how it's basically making their hardware look very, very good.
I was going to say,
other people buy hardware. So that, the idea with God of War was to basically create a visual masterpiece that really shows off the hardware to its maximum potential. And that was the goal. So the idea was that we could take as much time as we need, as much money as we need. And the goal was to make it look as best as possible. And of course, being part of that and being part of that visual team was really, really exciting. A lot of freedom.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, that I think Sony, obviously, they have their hand in two different pots, right? Like, yes, they want to make sure that the game is a success, but Sony also owns PlayStation, the brand. You know what I mean? So, like, making sure that you have a flagship product on your console that's not only going to impress fans but entice developers is like that's just something they have to do. They have to focus on that, So I don't blame them for actually taking that approach just on one game, because they still have a lot of in-house studios that are pushing exclusives that are doing really well and getting the acclaim. You have Naughty Dog, like Naughty Dog is definitely making sure that Sony is a talked about piece of hardware with Last of Us, with Uncharted, and whatever they're working on now with Amy Heading, with the Star Wars stuff.
You're right.
They're doing the Star Wars, right?
Yeah, they're doing Star Wars.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah, Visceral Games.
Yeah.
Like, what was it like? I'm thinking back. I don't think I've ever worked for a first-party studio before. Like, what was that like? Do you guys get special treatments? Do you guys get special Sony PlayStations that just fall from the roof every Christmas?
Well, no.
Fell off a truck.
In terms of, honestly, in terms of swag, and like free stuff. Yeah. And Sony was good, you know, we got backpacks, whatever. But I mean, nothing is good. Like the golden days of Call of Duty, you know, like Modern Warfare 3.
Oh, yeah.
And when Ghost, while I was on the Ghost, Call of Duty Ghost, I mean, those guys really had all, I mean, that's where Microsoft would just basically send a console for every member of the team just for fun. Yeah. Just like, here you go, guys. But at Sony, we had t-shirts and stuff, but we definitely had more swag and more free stuff at Call of Duty. It's at Infinity War at the time.
Uh-huh.
But what's interesting about Sony, working for first party and working for Sony Santa Monica at the time, was focus. You know, okay. The idea was that we can focus on the single hardware, on a single SKU, with the goal of making it look as good as possible, make it as awesome as possible. That's just be able to focus on the product and be able to just build a great team and have great funding and have opportunity to work on something that goal is not to make a lot of money from that product, but make it really, really beautiful and really, really awesome. Mm-hmm. That's just a rare opportunity. I think because it was not tied to sales, you know, it was just the goal was to make it something really, really good to show off the hardware, to basically show off the Sony. I think that the experience is really valid. Like, I mean, there's no way you can get it anywhere else. There's no way you can get this experience working for a third party developer that, you know, they need to make money with the game, and they have to cut corners on the visuals. They have to cut corners on performance for other things. That was not happening at Sony Santa Monica. And Sony Santa Monica, basically any crazy, wild, awesome idea team and directors could come up with, we were doing, and we were going for it. And that's really nice. It's pretty rare. So that's a big difference.
So I need to jump in and self-edit my last comment. Amy Hennig left Sony Santa Monica, and she's working on Star Wars now. I think that's why it was on the tip of my...
She left Naughty Dog.
She left Naughty Dog to go work on Star Wars. That's why I was on the tip of my tongue as I was talking about Naughty Dog. So going back to Yuri now, so I can bring this all together. You've worked on two big franchises, and as a fanboy, I got to know which one, as a developer and as an artist, self-taught, did you feel like you learned the most? But then which one do you feel like you had the most impact? If those are different questions, then answer them differently. But did you feel like one you were able to learn more from being on that project? And then which one of the two do you feel like you had more impact on, God of War or Call of Duty?
In both, to be frank, both of those projects, I learned really. I was about 5 years on God of War and 3.5 years on Call of Duty. So in God of War, I worked on two games. Well, I guess I worked on two games in Call of Duty as well. I would say that I learned, if I had to really compare, I would probably learn more working for God of War. But Call of Duty was also a great learning experience. And God of War, my experience was, what I've learned mostly was technical and my professional experience developing my craft. On Call of Duty, it was a little bit different. It was more about learning about business of the game development, learning about relationships within a team. There was a lot of growing I had to do, because when I came from Sony Santa Monica, I had a great team there, and we were all great friends, and we had a really good relationship. And I never really had to worry too much or work too much on my social skills or on my team building skills. And when I came to Infinity Ward, I sort of assumed that I'm going to step in exactly the same environment. I enjoyed the Sony Santa Monica, but socially it was very different in vibe. And so it took me a couple of years to kind of realize that I need to learn about, you know, being a part of the team that's not all my friends, and work with people that I might disagree with more often. So that was really good in that way. And also, what's interesting about Sony Santa Monica was that I could work on small projects to make them really, really good for long periods of time. When Call of Duty, the amount of time we had was much less. It was a two-year project, And the volume of assets, the volume of work had to be done was far greater than on God of War. So I had to learn how to step away from being a perfectionist that Sony Santa Monica allowed me to be and become more efficient to deliver more things faster. So it was just definitely very valuable. Both experiences are very valuable. Those two projects were very different. One was huge amounts of assets, but not very exciting, you know, thousands of humanoid assets, humans and human heads and human legs and human arms and human gloves, thousands of assets. And they're all kind of the same, not very exciting, but a big pipeline and 2 years of production versus 3 years of manually crafting every single creature, making it as best as possible and spending time, you know, just worrying about every single deformation, every single element, spending a lot of time on everything. So it's the very different experiences. I would say that both are very valuable. And today, looking back, I feel like I'm very well prepared to take on next projects just because simply because I have this really wide range of experience from those two, games.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned God of War was how long of a dev cycle? 5 years?
Well, so God of War, I was in God of War for 5 years, but the God of War 3 was in development for 3 years on a full team development. So the way they were doing this, God of War was done with 2 years of pre-production and 3 years of development. When I joined them, with development, full team development started. And after shipping God of War 3, I was in God of War Ascension for two years before I left to join Infinity Ward.
I see. Damn. Well, I mean, my average time on a game has been around 3 years. I don't think I worked on a single game more than 3 years on any of my games. I've heard stories of how stale it can get, depending, I guess, on the project. But, like, whenever I hear Blizzard working on, like, an 8-year game or a 10-year game, I cringe. Because even though it will become a success, right, like anything at Blizzard or whatever, just me going in, well, me looking at that dev cycle, it's not like you're creating new stuff. I see a lot of throwaway work, right? When you're talking about a game that exceeds 3 years, you're talking about things that you've tried and throw away more than anything that actually right. made it. So how was that process? Like, you being a technical artist, I mean, you must have tried a lot of stuff, or is it just making it easier for everyone else?
You know, what's interesting thing about God of War, I mean, okay, so Call of Duty and God of War are very different products, right? So Call of Duty, 2 years, and it was basically, when I got there, the idea was we reuse as much as possible. We get it out of the doors as fast as possible. We don't waste time.
Yeah.
We don't screw around with polishing every single bit. On God of War, the attitude was completely opposite of that. On God of War, the attitude was basically every single tiny bit has to be the best thing ever happened to game development.
Mm-hmm.
And what else is interesting, because God of War was game number 3, after game number 2, after God of War 2, technical art team realized that we cannot keep up with directors changing their minds the very last second if we don't have strong enough pipeline.
Yeah.
So the idea was let's not deny creatives the ability to do what they need to do if they need to make a change. As much as possible, provide them with support and tools. So the only way we can support these guys, the only way we can say, okay, if director comes in a month before office, says, you know what, this guy, I want this guy to have 2 heads instead of 3 heads, or like 2 heads instead of 1 head.
Mm-hmm.
We should be able to build the pipe in such a way where we can change characters and change things as fast as possible. So at the end of God of War 2, beginning of God of War 3, when I joined, we decided to build this pipeline where we can really, really fast, quickly iterate on character assets for rigging and animation, right? And so the idea was to build systems that allow us to change things very, very fast when directors, you know, felt like they want to change things. So yeah, so we did a lot of that. And first couple of games in God of War, they did a lot of people would go back and they would crunch a lot and they would change things manually. And for God of War 3, we just started building pipeline with understanding that things will change at the last moment. we need to be just prepared with tools to accommodate that. So that's what we, did. So that's it's important to think that it's important to figure out what you will need in development, and then see if there's a way with tools to provide support for that. So that's what we did. Even though God of War was interesting, because even though a lot of things were thrown away, it always felt like we did something really great, and so it never felt stale. However, after God of War 3, when God of War 4 happened, which was Ascension, that game definitely started feeling stale right off the bat. That was the fourth game in this series, and it was PS3 also, and it felt like it didn't really have its own identity. And it did not really go, did not really challenge anyone, didn't have any challenging new ideas. It was just more of the same. And morale was start changing. And a couple of years into it, I realized that it was just not, did not have the same excitement and the same, you know, same potential. So that's when I left. And of course, Ascension, when Ascension did ship a year later, it was not a successful game.
Yeah.
For these reasons, right? So I think that eventually franchises do get stale. Luckily for God of War 3, it was a brand new, it was a new system. It was a new director. It was very new look, and it was really strong team doing new kind of a new thing and exciting thing, like on the edge of technology. So that kept us going through the third one, but the fourth one really was couldn't continue, right? So that's why God of War took a big break.
Yeah.
I guess the rumors are that they're working on the next one. We'll see how that looks. But definitely, I think you're right. I think eventually games do run out of steam, and the developers do need to change of pace.
I mean, it's, I still like God of War 3 out of all of it so far. And it just makes sense, right? The third act of the story, there was a story to tell along with the graphical update and all the technical stuff that you guys wanted to achieve. So that game needed to be made. So I made a comment before, like I mentioned, you know, God of War 4 was the first year of my gaming history where it broke the trilogy mode, and it did it the same year Gears of War 4 came out. So I think that attributed to the worn outness of gamers, and maybe attributed to how it didn't do well. But I've always wondered internally, like, it felt like more of a marketing push for the studio than an actual story to tell in this universe. Like, Kratos is still angry. I don't even know what the fourth story is. The fourth story is a prequel, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be a prequel. Yeah, it's unclear. It was hard. It was one of the situations where Sony wanted to make, they wanted to cash in.
Yeah.
On God of War title, and it was tricky. It was I'm sure for designers it was really hard, because they couldn't really push it too much beyond what classic God of War was. It happens, you know, it happens a lot with games. Call of Duty is a great example of that, where you know, it's really hard for teams to make changes to a successful title, because it's successful. So, you know, publisher wants to make money, and they really wait for game to tank before they allow creatives to make big changes.
Right.
It's understandable. It just sucks to be a developer. You know, if you love your company, you love your team, you don't want to quit, you don't want to go anywhere else, you're happy with your life, you like it. It sucks that you have to deal with this. You have to wait. You know, I have friends at Sony Santa Monica now who's been there through the big, you know, the big dip they had when they had the big layoffs and a couple of games, that one game in council, Ascension, was not very good.
Mm.
Or, I mean, it was not very well received. So these guys lived through all these down, and now they make a new game, and the team is really excited, and they think it's going to be really great. But to live through those few years of, you know, downturn is really, it's not fun.
Where's you out? Yeah,
yeah. Where?
That's one of the toughest things. Like, you might be situated, you might like everything else, but if you're showing up to work and you're contributing 8 hours towards a project that you don't really believe in, like. Some people have a lot of tolerance with that, where their life outside of work is so great where they don't mind. I guess I haven't reached that level yet. I have to care about the project somewhat.
In my experience, the worse the project gone, the more people work.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, when things are going smooth and it's great, it's great. But when things go south and people feel like the game is not successful, project isn't going very well, that's when management starts to get stressed out, and your leads are all stressed out, and everybody worries, and people start to do more. Instead of fixing problems, people will usually start to do more of the same. Mm-hmm. You know, double down on bad ideas, essentially. It seems like what's happening a lot. Mm-hmm. And then inevitably, the more difficult the project is, the more people crunch, the more people work hard.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird, you know, the way it seems to be going. I guess there are a few exceptions. Some people, studios just work a lot, no matter if they're successful or not.
Yeah.
But in my experience, it's the more difficult things are going, the more people forced to crunch or work over time, because the ideas they're making are not good and they want to change things and they fall behind the schedule.
Yeah.
So it's always better to be on a really good project.
Yeah. I mean, it helps.
Right.
So what you've done, Yuri, like, you've been in the industry for 15 years, and Larry and I consider those guys like super, super senior, super scion survivors.
You put in your time, man, and earn your stripes.
Yeah. So what I've always been interested in, so I recently became a lead, right? So I'm still new to this. I've always been on the other glass of the executives when the studio has poor morale, or when the studio is dealing with problems that no one talks about, but it's like publicly being discussed on those walks around the block. Oh, yeah. So like, what, if you can you kind of illustrate like what goes on behind closed doors when these terrible things are happening to the studio that everyone knows about, but like not being addressed in the public meetings or stuff like that? Like, they obviously know what's going on. They obviously know that we know, but then is it mostly like, all right, how do we delay them from talking about it? Or is it more like, let's address this issue right now? Or it's like, fuck them, let's just finish the game. Like, what kind of attitude generally are the upper guys doing with this type of stuff?
I mean, for me, frankly, you know, for me, I guess I caught a little bit of endo. I caught some of negative. When I was at Sony Santa Monica, and I was lead there for a short period of time, and it was like a happy time. Uh-huh. And so there was not a lot of bad stuff happening. So it was kind of not at the very, right before I left, it was, you know, there were definitely some troublesome things going on, and leads would get together and we'd try to discuss about morale. But what's interesting about that studio, the studio was coming off really great run in terms of morale and quality and team. So they were just trying to get back to that place. But I feel like most of the time, in my experience, leads and executives, of course, when everybody knows when things aren't going well, they don't have much more of insight than the rest of us. Mm. It seems like they struggle with making these fixes. And that's, I think, if the fixing, it seems to me that executives wants to make it good as much as guys on the floor want to make it good.
Yeah.
And the reason things don't get any better usually, or get better very slowly, is because no one really knows how to do it. Yeah. And each situation is very different. The only difference for me personally between being just a guy on the floor and being involved in leadership is that at least I get the sense of trouble earlier than everybody else.
You have your life jacket earlier than
everybody. And you know exactly, and I feel like I have a little bit more control. I have a little bit more control over my destiny.
Yeah,
you know.
No, so that's definitely true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, if let's say I'm the junior who's coming into the big AAA studio working on these projects, what would be, you know, a big piece of advice that you would have for them as far as, you know, sensing the disturbance in the force? or is that even possible? I mean, from the bottom?
I don't think it's that hard. So I think sensing disturbance from the forest, the way you put it, it's not very hard. The writing is on the wall. I mean, it's clear. You know, in hindsight, any of us who have been in a situation look back and go, "Oh my God, that was absolutely clear. This thing is not going in the right direction."
Yeah.
It's really about trusting your gut, but you know, there's something to be said about dealing with troubled situation. Is you can either choose to quit and look for another job, or you can choose to, you know, make a commitment and stick to it. So there's benefit to both, and I think it depends on personality. You know, some people just very averse to losing a job, and they just don't want to. Like, I'm one of those people. I'm one of those people that I've never been laid off. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it's not exactly entirely true, but for purpose of this argument, I've never been laid off, and I've out of 5 companies I've worked for. So I worked for six companies. I worked for a company in Colorado, they shut down. Mm-hmm. Company in Chicago, they're gone. My first genuine games is gone. Collective is gone. Right? So like all those companies are gone, and guess what? I was never laid off. I left, I guess my very first company I was laid off because they just shut down while I was there. My very first company. Ever since then, I was leaving companies before they were shutting down because it was clear. Okay. So I think you have to be prepared. Working for a creative industry like ours, you know, things change very often. Companies, some big companies like Sony Santa Monica, some companies, maybe EALA, Infinity Ward, those companies might stick around for more than, you know, 2 projects. Okay. But a lot of companies, they try to do the best and then they shut down. You know, they just can't do it. It's really, really hard to stay in business. So I think if you want to be in this business, you'd be prepared that the company might shut down, and you need to be prepared with your whatever. If you're an artist, with your demo reel, if you're a programmer, with your technical skills, to prepare to, you know, look for another job, or have a good relationship with people outside of your job. So if you do lose a job, you have a lot of connections and contacts. I would say that in this industry, contacts and personal relationship is very valuable because the industry is small. After my very first job in the animation studio in Colorado, my every single job since then I've gotten because my friends invited me to go work for them.
Mm. Gotcha.
So, you know, don't be an ass and keep your skills up. And I would not worry too much about seeing problems coming up because they come up, they can be clear or they can come out of nowhere. It happens. You know, you'll just never know. You keep, one day you come to work and the door will be locked. And that happened. You know, it happened to friends of mine.
Yeah. Be wary the day that you see the U-Haul boxes just stacked up in the conference room.
Right. And it's not, that's the thing. It's not about you. At the end of the day, particularly in LA, you know, I feel like I work in the video game industry in LA, but it almost feels like I work in a video game on a video game developer team that is LA video game development team. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I work with all the different people throughout my career, and I feel like I'm working with them again, and we're kind of together making games. Yeah. And we just happen to be on different projects at different points in time. But even today, you know, I have friends asking me to join them, and you know, they're just waiting to see what's going to happen with my current career, my current position, and I'm waiting to see what the other people doing. I mean, literally, I just emailed a few guys tonight asking them if they want to come join us, while some other guys emailing me asking me to go join them. Mm-hmm. And it's all about friends. So I would say don't be too concerned about problems within the studio because it might happen. As a junior person, you will never know. You might have writing on the wall, but you know, you might never know. So you just be prepared that it might happen and it's fine. It's not a big deal. If you're good, there's lots of work.
Yeah, I feel like every developer needs to have like a rating percentage of how many studios that they worked for before closed down. So like you were mentioning yours, like I'm thinking back on mine, like I think 2 out of 5 companies closed since I've worked there.
Right.
That's That's crazy.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, it's like the guys. So what's interesting is this, you know, my very first company, Genuine Games, is shut down. I left literally 6 months later, they shut down.
Yeah.
I've worked with guys from those from studio several times since then. And they have a bunch of friends.
Yeah.
It, like 6 months ago, a dude called me up. He is a director at a very, like a very, very important studio in LA.
Yeah.
He goes, dude, come work with me. I need somebody like you with your expertise, with your experience. Like, you need somebody to come here and help me to run this thing. Yeah. Come.
Yeah.
And I worked with him over 10 years ago in this small studio that went out of business.
Yeah.
So the idea is that these are good guys everywhere. If team is small and it's failing and made it, somehow they made bad decisions along the way and made bad games, it does not mean that guys on the team are not good. It means that it was just one of those situations where it didn't work out, but we all learned through it. And maintaining this, maintaining relationships and maintaining your skills is far more valuable than worrying about what's going to happen in the, with the job you have right now. It's not a, that is not a long-term outlook.
Yeah. Like one of my favorite, one of my favorite questions that I usually get in my yearly reviews is, this is one of the reasons why I don't like producers. And if you're a good producer, like I said, disclaimer, I like you. It's just, I've known some bad producers out there. But usually in these meetings, they would ask me like, oh, so what's your 5-year plan, right? Pretty much it's like, when are you going to quit?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But I always take it with like, dude, what's your 5-year plan? Is the company's going to be around based on all these bad things that's happening right now? Like, why don't you tell me? Like, I can leave, but you're kind of stuck here because you're the company, man. So, I don't know. It's just one of those things, like you said, if you're realistic about the industry, right? Like anyone that you talk to, if you just look back seriously on their previous companies and how many of those are closed down, you can pretty much guess your career if you're a junior, like your trajectory of companies that you will work for will probably eventually close down. Like you, I can't think of many companies that if I start now, I'll be able to retire at 65. Like how many companies are 20 years plus? Right, yeah. In this industry, that's crazy.
If not even Google, you know, not even Google that. Like it's
Google doesn't even know.
No, so that's you know, if you think about these companies, like these, some of the biggest companies we deal with right now, they're like 10 years old. So what can I say? You know, it's not the years of our parents when you can think, okay, I work for General Electric, and I'll, you know, it's been around for 100 years. I'll be there for another 100 years. It's just the world is fast. Our industry is, at the end of the day, we're making it at entertainment and. It's fast moving industry. It's changing all the time, and people want to be creative. So the fact that it changes all the time, it's actually really great if you want to be creative. I think it's a really great benefit because young guys come to companies, they learn, and then they want to take the talent further, and they don't want to be stuck to pigeonhole situations in, you know, in at EA or Activision or somebody. You know, Infinity Ward right now, as far as I understand, is over 300 people team. Like right now, when I joined Infinity Ward, it was 75 guys. Now it's like, I think when they were shipping the last game, there were 350 people in the studio, in the office, like at Woodland Hills location. Well, what can you expect about your personal growth? And if you have your personal ideas, your personal aspirations, what can you do with that if you have such a huge company, you know, to grow through? It would be really difficult. I mean, you have to be extremely, extremely lucky and talented to be able to climb through that ladder. But then you can join a studio of 10 guys and you can, you know, pursue your dream. And I think that's the beauty of the industry. And I think that's why I'm glad it's this way. Yeah. But yes, security aside, it's really great.
It's just the guy who never been laid off. You're like, I'm glad. I don't know what you guys complain about. It's fine.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean.
No, I know what you mean. I mean, there's so much dynamic and flexibility within our industry. Like if you're good and you're focused, you'll be on your feet all the time. I mean, I think that's pretty true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Yuri, what's one of the exciting things that you look forward to still as a game developer?
Well, honestly, in terms of, I'm hoping that one day I can truly, well,
nothing, Larry.
I hope that one day I can really take advantage of all of my experience as a developer and have more control of a project in a way that actually is going to be easy and successful at the same time.
Easy and successful. That is a great goal.
Easy and successful at the same time. Because it's been hard.
Yeah.
And, so, yeah, and the thing is, sometimes I see myself and my friends making a mistake. And I'm just like, I just see this is a mistake. And we walk, it's right in front of me and we're walking right into it. I know it's bad. We're just walking right into it. It's going to be bad. I'm going to step on something. I can see it's not a surprise. And so hopefully one day I'm not going to do that. But I mean, for me, it's really hard to say what I'm looking forward, because truthfully, I'm like the last 10 years of my career has been as exciting as I can imagine. So like working on God of War was unbelievable because it was the most exciting game at the time. And I was able to join the team. And of course, Call of Duty is awesome because, I mean, it's Call of Duty. It's, you know, 27 million people bought that game.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's pretty incredible. Of course, now I work for a small team and I have a lot more say. At least I think I do. And
we let you say it, but
we're not listening. Like I say stuff, but no one listens really. But it's okay. No, and
huge impact. Yeah, sure.
And you know, so it's a lot of new challenges right now. So it's been really exciting. I feel like as long as it can go the same, it continues to be like this, where it's new and exciting. I can be part of great projects. I continue to work with great people. That's another thing about the industry is that you get to work. You really get to work with creative people, and that's, you know, that's rare. Because most industries, most jobs don't offer you opportunity to have lunch with somebody who is a great painter, or somebody who thinks about sound and music all day long, and somebody who thinks about concept art, somebody who thinks things about storytelling all day long. You know, here you get to have a chance to hang out, have coffee with somebody who is creative, very creative person, and it's enriching. It's wonderful, and I really don't see how things get much better in terms of my job.
Ooh,
it's nice. As good as it gets, really.
If there was one project or one franchise out there that you didn't get to work on yet, which one would you go and work on? Does it exist even?
And for what reason? Yeah.
Oh, man. Okay. So, all right. So if I'd love to work on a franchise with it, if I want to be working with a team,
All right. So Yuri has put down the microphone. He is running across the room to grab something. Oh, he's got a game.
Yeah. It would be guys who made this.
Oh,
okay. You got to learn some Japanese then.
Yeah, definitely From Software would be. Yeah. From Software, those guys. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I never played those games before until Bloodborne came out about a year ago. And I have to say that, I mean, I have never played a game as much. It's a single player campaign that I spent over 250 hours.
250 hours?
Yeah.
So for the listeners out there, he held up Dark Souls 3. If you don't know where From Software is, they're in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, it would be really difficult for me to work there. You know, the Japanese, from what I understand, don't like, you know, it would be hard. But that would be, I mean, that's really right now the game that they do things in the way that I feel like Bloodborne is like a master class of video game development.
Why do you feel that way? Is it because, well, graphically it looks cool, gameplay, it just everything fits as a game?
Yeah, well, okay, so, I mean, design is amazing, obviously. But like, for me as a developer, you know, I look at the development choices that I make. So, for example, like one thing is, so when I started playing Bloodborne, I was still working on Call of Duty, okay? Mm-hmm. And at the time, we had a guy who came from Central, and his full-time job was fixing blend shapes for scans for the facial animation. Okay. So doing facial animation today in today's world is notoriously expensive and very difficult. And the amount of time and people hours it spend on doing this stuff is just really mind boggling. I mean, it's unbelievable how much time people spend, companies spend on making facial animation look good. And I was not really involved in that so much, but I knew guys who work in it. Some guys on my team were working on facial animation tools and technology, and just insane amount of hours and money was spent on it. And then I play a game like Bloodborne, and there's an NPC is talking to me, and he is behind closed door telling me a story. Mm. So this game, these guys were able to create. So in this game, Bloodborne, there's no facial animation at all anywhere.
Yeah.
Not even mouth moving. Uh-huh. And when I played the game and I still had experienced emotion and excitement and all the things that designers intended for me to experience as a player, and they paid $0 and 0 cents for facial animation, to me, that's a really smart development, right? Mm-hmm. So these guys were just and there's so many things about that game where they spent money and spent time on certain elements that are very valuable and important for the experience, the game experience. And they really cut their losses on other things that are not very important. Mm-hmm. And it's fine. So, cloth, for example, Bloodborne cloth is insane. It's everywhere. And it breaks all the time. It looks like when you see it for the first time, it just looks terrible. But after playing for half an hour, you just don't care anymore. And you just buy into it and you're just moving on. And Unknown God of War, for example, we spend an insane amount of hours just trying to make Kratos' skirt look good at any possible situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was very, very hard to do. We spent an insane amount of hours with me and programmer, and we just worked for, 6 months easily to make his little skirt look good in every possible situation. We could have saved ourselves 5 months worth of work if we allowed it to clip through his legs once in a while. Yeah. That is a smart development.
Yeah.
And Bloodborne just have many, many examples of that type of attitude towards the development of the game, where the experience trumps small technical, achievements that are really meaningless in a big mm-hmm. picture. That's something that for us as developers, it's really hard to overcome. Like it's really hard for the development team to overlook small minor imperfections and see for the big picture. So I think that's really, really valuable. And I think it's interesting. It's just sometimes it's interesting how these people think, how this team decides what is important for them and what is not important for them. These decisions are really hard. And, for example, I always talk about Titanfall and Respawn, right, games. The first game they shipped, there was no single player. I'm just curious how those guys internally came up with this decision. Like, how they decided as a team, we're going to cut single player, like unheard of and crazy, and they got lots of flack for it. Somebody on this team somehow was able to articulate that idea in such a way that team agreed. I mean, that's what I'm looking forward to. Like, I think Titanfall, Respawn will be game company in LA that I would love to work with just to learn from them how they make these, to me, what seems like really smart decisions. If all my dreams come true, I would love to spend a year or two working with guys from software.
Oh, nice.
They're pretty awesome. But from my personal goals, I would say that at this point in time, I want to work on the small teams making quick games.
Yeah.
Making games that take 6 months to ship.
Yeah.
That would be the goal. Realistic goal for my going forward. I think if I can work on games that are short cycles, like 6 months to a year, that would be much better than spending 3 years or 5 years on a game.
I think I'm starting to understand your easy and successful formula that you're trying to achieve here. I mean, it's true, right? We've been through the ringer so many times, and the long-term investment doesn't always pay off. And I think it's one of the issues that's crippling AAA development right now is just so many resources are being thrown in something so minuscule for detail's sake, where it really does shut down studios for these decisions, right? It might make the art people happy internally, right, but is that really a smart business decision? So the more we think about business than just the artistic expression of a developer, I think whatever that balance is probably healthy for us, right, to like not animate mouths. Who cares? Let's just get the emotion out. This right. is our game. It's a style. So there you go.
Right. I mean, the first time I came across that, it was in Call of Duty, working for Infinity Ward. When I first joined Infinity Ward, there was still a lot of that mentality of the old crew of Infinity Ward. You know, those, and when I joined them, it was after the old crew left, mm-hmm. right? And the old crew was 70 guys, and they were making fantastic, you know, Modern Warfare 1 and 2. They were just amazing flagship games. And they were done with the rumor is, no crunch ever, uh-huh. long vacations, ton of money, and the best games on the market. And the team was like 70 guys. So when I got there, you know, there was still a little bit of the philosophy. Some of the philosophies that team had was still around. It was interesting to learn it. And, you know, the very important things, like, don't waste your work. Don't do art until levels are done. Like, these guys actually practiced those ideas, you know. And that's really incredible. After God of War, but God of War was not that. God of War was just making the most beautiful thing, and if you have to change it, we'll just change it. These guys were not. They were in two-year cycles, and they were making games fast, and they were about how to make them as easy as possible, you know. How little do we have to do to make this game, right? Yeah. And if you're a smart developer, if you're a good developer, that is how I think you're supposed to think.
Yeah.
You know, how little can I do? How many tricks can I use? Instead of trying to figure out the perfect shader that reflects the reality, how can we hack it? How can we trick it so it seems 90% there, with 10% worth of work, you know, it required right, to make right. it. That's a really difference. I mean, even today, you know, Titanfall 2 just shipped, and those guys still were 70 guys.
Yeah.
The team is still 70, like what, maybe 90 people, maybe, but still, I think it's still less than 100 people. While Call of Duty, of course, is a much bigger game, but, you know, from what I understand, people love in Titanfall 2, and there's a, in terms of storytelling and first person story experience, apparently it's really, really good.
Yeah.
I'm sort of waiting to play it a little bit later, maybe next month or two. But same thing, those guys continue to do that. They continue to practice that idea. And if I look at the trailer of the game, for example, or some gameplay, the character art, for example, is not nearly as high fidelity as Call of Duty.
Yeah.
But from what I hear, people playing the game, they really get involved with the characters and really experience the drama of the story. I think a long and hard look should take on price you pay as a developer to achieve what results you want to achieve. And at the end of the day, we deliver an experience, and we need to really clearly understand whether we need to put our effort into things that will not improve experience or will make it, you know, will not, is it worth for experience to put so much effort, so many human hours into it? Because, you know, people, yeah.
Well, you know, like God of War, it had its trilogy. Trilogies come to an end. All good things come to an end. My friend, we have reached that point. It is 1 hour into the podcast. We've been talking about your life, your musicianship, your jobs, your skills, how to survive in the AAA industry, and what projects have been your favorite, what teams you want to work for, and the fidelity crisis between God of War and then also Call of Duty level games. At this time, we're going to give you a little thank you for participating in this wonderful podcast. Brandon and I are going to be quiet for a little while and let you just say to the audience, promote something that you're working on, maybe thank a mentor or a tutor who helped you early on. As our thank you for being on this podcast, we're going to give you the floor to just basically say it real quick, you know, like, hey, thanks for listening. I'm Yuri. Go check out this game. Go this and that, da, da, da. You know, stay strong, stay off drugs, go to college, eat your greens, whatever you want to do. The floor is yours.
All right. Thanks. All right. Hey, guys. So, again, my name is Yuri Nederland, and I work for Section Studios right now. And I would say that definitely go check out Titanfall 2. I have a lot of friends working on that game. Apparently, they're not selling as well as they should. So I'd say play that game. And the game industry is really exciting, and it's going to be here for a long time, but it's fluid and moving around. So you have to be, you know, prepared for downfalls. I think it's really, really good industry to work for. And if you can make a career in it, I think it will be great and rewarding. And personally, I just want to thank, obviously my whole life is full with people that are great and help me along. But I'll say this one person that I want to thank specifically is Brian Weaver. I had really cool, I was close friends with him for a long time. We don't talk much anymore, but the guy helped me multiple times throughout my career. And he's just a really creative dude. So yeah, that's pretty much it. I would say follow your dreams and work hard, and that should be fine. As long as you do what you love, I think it'll be okay.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is that time of the podcast where I go like this and I talk really high and I say good night.
Hey, this is Brandon Pham. Thank you for listening to us this week. See you again next week. I'm out.
Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to stay in touch or continue to follow our developments, then you need to go to facebook.com/GameDevUnchained and drop a like and stay in touch. You can also get the direct feed for this podcast on soundcloud.com/GameDevUnchained.